If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is expedient not to marry. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. Our confessions teach that the ministry is the rock on which the church is built. St. Peter's confession was the clarifying moment in which the church was defined as the pillar of truth and the fortress of salvation. But that was yesterday. Ministers without congregations should be required to preach on the assigned texts to give them an opportunity to expand their vocabularies. Today's reading on taxes and marriage are not promising. Preparing taxes is an annual catharsis. Going through the receipts and the credit card statements is a preliminary judgment day. That doomsday book records our financial indiscretions. The appropriate hymn is verse 5 of this hymn, Day of Wrath, O Day of Mourning. Lo, the book exactly worded, wherein all hath been recorded, then shall judgment be awarded. The good news is that we Christians are exempt from taxes because in Jesus, God's kingdom is here. We are free and no longer subject to the laws of government, which have no standing with God. Luther called this Christian liberty. The bad news is that this exemption is not listed in the IRS code. Jesus went on to say that we should not flaunt this liberty in front of unbelievers who want one more reason for not becoming Christians. So pay your taxes. Ironically, Peter did not use his own money to pay the tax. To pay the temple tax, he retrieved a coin from a fish's mouth, which went directly into the hands of Jesus' executioners. Later, it funded Christianity's first persecutors. Objection: with government policy like crucifixion, stoning, and abortion, or with church programs, is no reason to withhold our contributions. To say the un-American thing, the Boston Tea Party was wrong. Now we go from what annoys us to what is delicately embarrassing. Dr. Laura said that none of the parents of her childhood friends were divorced. Many of us who are of that same age know that's true. For every one divorced person in 1900, there are now about 50. All this in spite of Dobson's focus on the family, marriage counseling, and counseling courses for seminary students. 50 years ago, a pastor saw no divorced persons sitting in the pews. Now he faces a congregation who would rather not hear that a man and wife are one flesh and are to stay that way. Call this law because Moses wrote it down, but Jesus defined it as the Christian life. Fidelity required in marriage is a reflection of the mutual fidelity between God and the believers. Call this gospel. At weddings, parents often deal with four sets of parents and step-parents instead of the traditional two. And it is a problem where they are to stand and sit. It is reasonably reported that conservative Lutherans, like ourselves, like sermons against homosexuality, but not about the inviolability of marriage. It is a kind of a red-necked morality in yuppie clothing. Sermons targeted to specific topics make congregations uncomfortable. But as mentioned, preaching on assigned readings is a necessary self-imposed bondage of the will. Let's resolve the difficulty by invoking goal, malady, and means. The goals are clear. Pay your taxes, though no fish will provide your quarterly payment. And secondly, stay married to the same person, an idea which even the disciples of Jesus found outrageous. Moses was a man of God, and he said if the first marriage did not work out, the second one might do the trick. With Jesus taking this option off the table, the disciples cast their vote for celibacy. But he also said, don't take staying single too seriously, because God created us for marriage. If we can trust Paul, Peter, and the other apostles understood what Jesus said and stayed married to their wives. The maladies are simple. All are tempted not to pay taxes, at least not all of them, and when the sledding gets tough, to reach for the divorce option. But what are the means in goal, malady, and means? First, the negative means. Call it law, but it's just reality. This world is passing away faster than any of us expected. Nothing, including governments which require taxes, or marriages or families which require interpersonal fidelity, lasts forever. The money we don't lose while living, we will lose in dying. Cynicism, which is certain of nothing, is certain of death and taxes. Death ends happy situations, but it relieves strained ones. Until death do us part applies both to our marriages and our money. So much for negative solutions to bad situations. The positive means or solution is that Christ has come as God's eternal kingdom. And this kingdom has nothing to do with taxes or marriage. Paul caught the gist of what Jesus had said. Because Christ will soon appear, it did not matter to him whether he was rich or poor, or whether Christians were married or unmarried. Married people should stay married. Others, like himself, opted for the single life. But he spoke so eloquently about marriage, one has the suspicion that he himself was once married. Since Christ has come, and since Christ will come again, life's unpleasantries are at least tolerable. Sorrows will be replaced by indescribable splendors and delights. 2 million people in Times Square welcomed the year 2000, shouting 10, 9, 8, 7. The ball dropped, the crowds cheered, poof, it was over. The next day on 60 Minutes, disappointed revelers said nothing really happened. And they were right. Y2K was all media hype and still is. All this is an allegory. The person who regards the money with which he pays his taxes, or which he or she keeps for him or herself, or the person who regards his spouse, family, friends, as more important than Christ, is living a life of self-deception. The ball drops. Poof, it's over. Anyone who loves his family more than Jesus is not worthy of him. The same goes for money. It's God or it's mammon, but not both. Perhaps in the back of Jesus' mind, as he spoke of the problem of paying taxes and keeping marriages together, were words which Peter and the disciples already knew. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Perhaps only after Jesus had been raised from the dead did they fully realize that God's kingdom, which freed them from otherwise intolerable situations, had once stood before them. He stands before us now, and in retrospect, you will have to decide whether we should have broached these sensitive topics. But then again, the time is never right for uncomfortable topics.